2005 UTC right after the international news.
You're welcome, Straight Talk Africa, coming to you from my home in Arlington, Virginia, a suburb of Washington, D.C. I am Shaka Salee, and today we'll reflect on some recent major developments in the Republic of Sudan.
For the latest developments in the Republic of Sudan, I am joined by my colleague, John Tanza, host and managing editor of VOA's South Sudan in Focus radio program. I have to say, frankly, that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly gratified to have the opportunity to interact with you on this special edition of Straight Talk Africa.
The feeling is mutual, Shaka Salee. Thank you for having me.
You're most welcome. You know, it's been quite some time since the overthrow of President Omar al-Bashir from Khartoum. Give us an update. What's happening on the ground in the Republic of Sudan? There were so many promises made. To what extent have some of those promises been delivered?
I would start with the latest, being that there was a cabinet reshuffle 2 weeks ago. That's in line with the Juba Comprehensive Peace Agreement that was signed by the transitional government and various rebel groups fighting in Darfur and Blue Nile State. So the term of the agreement was dictating that the transitional government reshuffles the cabinet and forms a new one to include rebels who signed an agreement with the transitional government. That was done. Five women were also appointed in that cabinet, which is a record in the history of Sudan. And that is the latest, but the people who chased Bashir away are still on the streets demanding for change. They are saying they are not seeing all the pledges that were made by the transitional government to the people who, you know, struggled so hard to unseat Bashir. For instance, they are talking about the economic crisis. It's still difficult to put bread on the table in Sudan.
You know, as well as I do, that the transitional government promised the people of Sudan that it would immediately introduce what it characterized as social justice. How far, to what extent have they been able to deliver on that?
The people that I speak with in Sudan, journalists, analysts, and the ordinary old friends in Sudan, are still saying that they're not seeing any changes. If anything, the only change is that Bashir is not in power, but his lieutenants are still in control of the economy. For instance, they are saying the price of bread has actually tripled, you know, before it was at affordable price during Bashir's time, but it was not available. Now it's available, but the price have gone up. The price of gasoline has gone up, and transportation is a challenge. So the people are saying the promises made are yet to be fulfilled.
Wait a minute, John. How can you talk like that? You are talking as if, in fact, what we saw was a change of guards. These are people who actually said theirs was not a change of guard, but rather a fundamental change.
Correct. You can. It depends on who you speak to. I interviewed a former state minister in the Ministry of Labor in Sudan, and he told me that the reason why he resigned is because Yes, the top executive from the people who brought change, the ministers and whatnot. But the technocrats in most of the institutions in Sudan are Bashir's loyalists. And so they could frustrate you if you want to bring change. And the case of the state minister was one. He said he was not able to work. You know, everything he wants to do is not recognized. So he decided to quit. So in essence, yes, there is a change of guard, but the technocrats, the people who have the know-how, are still, most of them are still Bashir's loyalists. This is what people are telling us from Sudan.
But what about the fact that the transitional government has at least succeeded in one major area? It succeeded, for example, in making sure that the name of the Republic of Sudan was removed from the United States list of countries that support or sponsor terrorism. To what extent has that been reflected on the ground? To what extent has that been, for example, welcomed on the ground and in the
region? Of course, there was a tremendous welcoming of that news by the ordinary people, because the ordinary people believe that when Sudan is lifted from the list of countries sponsoring terrorism, it means that U.S. companies will come and invest in Sudan. And once U.S. companies invest in Sudan, it translates into creating jobs for the ordinary people. Now, the politicians, the members of the Transitional Government of National Unity, hail it as one of their landmark success, because this is going to give Sudan an opportunity to interact with the international community on equal footing. But the other, you know, quarters of the society, especially the Islamists, are not seeing it as victory, because they look at it like it's a surrender to the Americans, or to what they will call the infidels. And so these are what other analysts are telling us. For instance, the normalization of relations with Israel. The executive is praising it as a milestone, but the fundamentalists, the Islamists, are saying, wait a minute, you're supposed to have a parliament. It's the parliament to decide which country Sudan should normalize relations with, not the military or the transitional government. So that in itself is a problem there.
From your reporting, how has the domestic constituency, for example, reacted to the normalization of the relationship with Israel? And what about the African Union and the Arab League?
I would start with the Arab League. There was a little bit of, if you like, mute reaction from the Arab League. The Palestinians made noise that this is against what was agreed in 1947, that no Arab country should establish a relationship with Israel. The Palestinian authority came clear on that, but some Arab countries have been mute on that development. Back in Sudan, before the late leader of the Umar Party, Sadiq al-Mahdi, when he spoke to us, he said, that was a mistake by the Transitional Government of National Unity, because the government has no mandate from the people to transact on behalf of the Sudanese people. Late Sadiq al-Mahdi said the Transitional Government should have waited for a parliament to be constituted, and then it's the parliament to decide which country Sudan should normalize its relationship with. Of course, the ordinary people, some people did not want to make their feelings known, but the Islamists were not happy because of their long-held hostility towards the state of Israel.
Well, on that note, Ndugu John Tanza, it was a pleasure interacting with you.
The feeling is mutual, Shaka Sali. I feel privileged to be on this show.
You're most welcome, sir.
Thank you, John, for that interesting report. And now joining me to discuss the recent developments in the Republic of Sudan
are two distinguished guests. Nurdin Sati, the Sudanese ambassador to the United States of America, and Temi Ablogba, program and research associate the Africa program at the center of international policy. Well, I have to say, frankly, Nuruddin and Temi, that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host the two of you on this special edition of Straight Talk Africa.
We are honored also, Shaka. Thank you very much. It's an honor and a pleasure to be on your program. Thank you very much for the invitation.
Thank you for having us.
You're most welcome, Temi. Let's go to the important topic of the Republic of Sudan. You have had significant changes in your country, Ambassador Nuruddin. What are some of the major accomplishments so far by the Sudanese transitional government?
The major accomplishment, I would say that one of them actually took place only 2 days ago, trying to control our currency. You know that for so many years, Sudan had a dual system of currency exchange, and 3 days ago, the central bank took a very bold decision to unify the rate of exchange of the pound, the Sudanese pound, and this is, I understand, working very well, and this will help us to improve the performance of our economy and our financial systems. But of course, the most significant accomplishment for us for the time being has been resumption of normal relations with the United States, of the international community at large, and having Sudan removed from the list of countries harboring or sponsoring terrorism. I think that was a major achievement for Sudan. And building on that, we have opened up to international transactions, and now American companies are welcome and available to work in Sudan. Another, of course, major achievement was signing a peace accord in Juba with a number of armed groups, which have now joined the government. A few days ago, we had a cabinet reshuffle in which a number of leaders of those armed groups joined the government. And I think this is another very significant achievement that will help us move forward.
To what extent would you say the most recent cabinet reshuffle looks like Sudan?
It looks like Sudan because it recognizes the diversity of the Sudanese people. It's also, whether it is from a regional, political, or ethnic point of view, linguistic point of view. And it helps us to address some of the major challenges that have been with us, I would say, since independence, the issue of to be able to manage our diversity. This, for me, this has been really the major issue in Sudan. And now we are working on that. And I hope that this formula will help us now to turn to resolving other issues, such as the issue of governance, how are we going to rebuild and restructure the state, how are we going to do our nation building, and how are we going to be able to move together as one Sudanese people.
Tell me, I know that you pretty much monitor the developments across the African continent. To what extent would you agree with Ambassador Nuruddin about some of the major accomplishments that have been done or achieved by the Sudanese transitional government?
Yeah, I definitely agree with the points that the ambassador made. Definitely the removal from the state-sponsored terrorism list was a major accomplishment for this transitional government, because it's one of the promises that they made when they came into power. The removal from the list has allowed them to begin receiving international aid. At the beginning of January, the former U.S. Treasury Secretary announced that Sudan will begin to receive $1 billion annually for the World Bank. So that's a really strong example. And like he said, they've been allowed to rejoin the international community now, So this includes things like receiving debt relief, increased foreign investment, and these are all things that removal from that list have been able to facilitate. So, you know, they are succeeding in accomplishing those promises they made when they came into power. And then, of course, in terms of bringing democracy and peace, you know, the agreement that was made between the transitional government and the coalition of rebel leaders in South Sudan, you know, with the promises of ending devastating wars in Darfur, Blue Nile, and other places, you know, is definitely a very strong move. You know, some weaknesses or worries experts have is that maybe, you know, the lack of international help and also trying to promote democracy in the middle of intersecting crises may be very difficult, but nonetheless, it still should be something that they consider an accomplishment.
To what extent have some of those major accomplishments, Nuruddin, been, for example, welcomed by the vast majority of the Sudanese people on the ground?
No, they have certainly been welcomed with a lot of enthusiasm by the people, because these are parts of the what the people have been calling for so many years. So the people are really very happy about those changes, certainly. But this does not mean that we are not other serious concerns concerning the economy, for example, and the livelihoods of the people. That's another issue that we are grappling with. And we are hoping that the decision taken 3 days ago will help us achieve the objective of improving the livelihoods of the people.
How do you reconcile that view with the criticism emanating from people that are characterized as Islamists, as saying that the transitional government really has pretty much sold out to the Americans, especially when we talk about the normalizing of relations, which of course resulted in your country's removal on the list of the US countries who sponsor or promote terrorism?
Well, I do not see it that way. It's not sold out. Actually, I see it the other way around. I see the US is supporting the legitimate, call for peace and justice and democracy and freedom in Sudan. There is an alignment of values between us and the United States and the international community. And this alignment of values has been absent for so many years, for 30 years under the Islamists, because they wanted to take us, the society, and actually the Muslim world in the wrong direction. Mm-hmm. So we are not being selling to anybody. All that we are doing, we are reaffirming our own values, and those values tally with those of the Americans and the international community. And that's why we are very comfortable about what we are doing, and we'll continue on that path.
Let's go back to the late 1990s, when your country was accused for having aided Osama bin Laden and his colleagues for bombing the United States embassies in Kenya and Tanzania, when the United States reacted by bombing a facility that later turned out to be a pharmaceutical facility or factory. Has that, for example, been taken care of by the United States? Have they admitted that it was a mistake?
And yes, they have.
And to what extent have they, in fact, been able to compensate you?
Yes, they have. They have been, you know, it has become a court case, and the owner of that facility went to court, and the court system has found him, you know, gave him on the right side, and this matter has been closed quite early through the legal system.
Tell me, the ambassador talks about normalizing of relationships with Washington. And he, in fact, adds about normalizing relationship with Israel. How has that played in the region, for example? Because you know as well as I do that there is an outstanding policy of the African Union and the Arab League, rather, on how to deal with the issue of the Palestinians and the State of Israel.
Yeah, so in terms of the region and how Africa is perceiving these policy changes, you know, Hamdok, you know, himself believed that, you know, requiring the normalization of relations did have the potential to unravel Sudan's democratic transition. You know, when they were making this decision, they were quite worried about how the people may react, because there was this perception that the U.S. may be forcing Sudan's hand rather than an organic agreement between two countries that was agreed on by popular mandate from the Sudanese people and the government, therefore representing the people's interests. And internationally, the same belief is held. Within Africa, though, it's clear that the Israeli PM is, you know, really has his sights set on Africa, because now Morocco is normalizing ties as well. And he's sought to develop ties with multiple African states. So in terms of how African nations are viewing Israel when it comes to policy, you know, they're observing the potential economic benefits of renewed and closer ties. And they're also, you know, looking at the fact that, you know, Israel is showing interest in them, so maybe how they can wager in this, you know, foreign policy playground.
Ambassador Nuruddin, what about the issue of Jerusalem as the capital of the state of Israel? To what extent does the Republic of Sudan recognize Jerusalem as the capital of the state of Israel?
We do not recognize it at all. The status of Jerusalem has been clearly identified as the haven of the three Abrahamic religions, and it has been put under certain tripartite authority, and this question should continue, and this status should continue. We do not accept that Jerusalem becomes the capital of the State of Israel. We are for a solution that would cater for peace and stability in the region while recognizing the rights of the Palestinian people for their own state. And I'm very happy to see, we are very happy to see that the new administration, the U.S. administration, has declared that it was also supporting the two-state solution. And that's exactly what we are advocating for. Concerning the Palestinians, for us now, we need really to think very carefully how we can help Palestine and how we can help the Palestinians. Can we help them by continuing the same policies of hostility that continued for 70 years without producing any positive effects? Or can we help them by adopting another attitude which would bring peace, stability, and reconciliation to the region, and which everybody will profit, and which the Palestinians themselves will thrive and be able to claim their rights, their rights in a kind of a pacified atmosphere, and where Israel and Israelis will recognize that peace and stability and giving the Palestinians their rights are in the interest of the state and people of Israel.
Ambassador Nuruddin, I know that you are an impeccable diplomat, plenipotential and extraordinary to boot, and this is really not a hypothetical situation. Is it reasonably possible that you could, in fact, recognize the State of Israel without recognizing its capital?
It is possible. It's quite possible. I think that we have to find a way of dealing with that. For the time being, that's the formal position of my government. We do not recognize Jerusalem as the capital of the State of Israel. We are now talking about the possibility of normalization with Israel. And when we come to the negotiations, we are going to put this on the table and see how we are going to deal with that.
Tell me, educate me a little bit about diplomatic niceties. Is it sincerely possible for one country to recognize another country without, in fact, having the implication that you also equally recognize the capital seat of that particular country?
I think it's definitely a very complex issue. I think what the ambassador said, however, shows how they can try to reconcile that and try to balance it. But I do definitely think it's very complex and points to, you know, a really long history that has a lot of, like I said, complexities. You know, this dates back to the Arab-Israeli war and, you know, Sudan choosing not to, you know, recognize or starting hostilities with Israel since then. So, you know, I think with the correct diplomacy in place, you know, it can happen. And what the removal from the state sponsors, the terrorism list, and the normalizing of relations as we see today shows a step in the right direction in terms of diplomacy.
Let me say that we are dealing with an unprecedented situation, an unusual situation. We need to be very creative about what we are going to do and think very carefully about it. We are talking to the Israelis, and we started talking to them about the possibility of normalization. We are not yet there. Mm-hmm. We are moving towards that. There are many hurdles to be removed. And my prime minister and leader of my state have said very clearly that this is a question that will be discussed by the legislative assembly, which is being formed now. In the process, we need to think very carefully about what kind of engagement we are going to have with Israel and what kind of things that we can accept and what kind of other things that are not acceptable to us. And this is what negotiations are about. And then, the main objective is to move forward and find a settlement to the Palestinian problem and to the relations between Palestinians and Israelis and between Palestinians and Sudanese and other nations or countries that are involved in this crisis, in this problem that has been going for too long. The objective being peace and stability in the region while preserving the rights of the Palestinian people.
You know, when the transitional government of Sudan came into power, it said what happened was a fundamental change. And yet, there are a lot of critics who have actually been saying that in their view, not mine, what happened in the Sudan is not a fundamental change, but a change of guards. What are some of the most important challenges that the transitional government of Sudan is facing so far?
Well, I spoke about the economic issue, the financial issue, the livelihoods issue. I said, for me, this is the main problem. This is the major problem. Mm-hmm. Other problems are those pertaining, of course, to the reorganization of the state and the rebuilding the state on democratic basis, on equitable basis, resolving those issues that have been with us for too long the issue of management of diversity that I mentioned earlier. We have also the issue of dealing with how are we going to move forward in a democratic on a democratic path while dealing with the legacy of the past. We have had totalitarian regimes in Sudan. We have a society that has been used and utilized in a certain way. We need to turn around this society and in order to really implement in a meaningful way the slogans of the revolution: freedom,